Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Thursday, and that means open forum here at Catholic Answers Live. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, your question is welcome here today. 888-318-7884 is our number, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of The Fathers Know Best, The Drama of Salvation, A Daily Defense. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing?
I am very, very well.
Good.
And are you getting some rest now that you finished your new upcoming book?
Not so much.
No?
No, I've been writing a bunch of little short things and turning them in.
That's the thing about a big project, huh? It's you're just putting off all the little projects.
Or they suddenly descend on you unexpectedly afterwards.
Oh. Oh.
Like I had a magazine article to write for Catholic Answers magazine.
Yeah.
It's for our faith and science issue. Mm-hmm. And so Tim Ryland asked me to write an article on faith and science fiction.
Nice.
Where I deal with the faith implications of some concepts from science fiction.
Uh-huh.
Also, Todd Aglioloro asked me to write a post for Catholic Answers magazine online, mm-hmm. Which is up now on an argument about deportations and what the church teaches about deportations.
Did that go up today, Nat?
Yesterday, I believe.
Oh, I missed it. Okay, I got to read that one.
And I had the National Catholic Register ask me to write a couple of months' worth of Sunday gospel reflections for them, or Sunday reading reflections for them. So I've been working on those.
How cool, Jimmy.
Yeah.
So you'll be prepared for Mass now for a couple months. You'll have reflected on the gospels
including
already.
Including this Sunday. This morning I woke up at like 6 a.m. and I checked my email and I had an email from the editor saying, the person who was going to write one this Sunday couldn't. Could you? So like, yeah, I got an hour. Bang. Okay, here you go.
That's awesome. Well, very, very good. Yeah, and you mentioned Todd. Todd is – I mean, Tim Ryland is the editor of the Catholic Answers magazine. Todd mm-hmm. Aglioloro is the head of Catholic Answers Press,
mm-hmm.
and both big important figures around here.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, it looks like the calls are already pouring in, loads
awesome.
Of them. Should we just start with our callers?
Let's do.
All right. Nate in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. You start us off today. Nate, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Good afternoon, guys. I was talking with a Catholic friend about deathbed confessions, and we were just wondering if there's ever been a case where someone was so bad, like Caligula from the movies bad, that tried to sneak in at the last minute with a deathbed confession, and that had church ever or a bishop or a priest ever been known to have said, no, not you, or that'll make us look bad, or you don't mean it, or some type of denial of a deathbed confession.
The only circumstances under which it's legitimate to deny someone confession are, I guess there's two. The first one is to deny someone absolution. The first one is if the confessor determines that the penitent is not really penitent, that they're just faking. But that is a very high burden to overcome. The presumption, and this is going to apply double extra super chocolate special at deathbed time, is that the person is sincere. You would have to have really overpowering evidence that this person is not actually sinful to deny them absolution if they're about to die. The second is situations where the person has committed what's called a reserved offense. This is an offense that where an ordinary priest doesn't have the faculty needed to absolve it. Certain ecclesiastical crimes are you have to go to a higher authority, like the local bishop, let's say, in order to have a particular offense absolved. But the thing is, those also don't apply at deathbed time. So the church is really concerned to make sure that everybody is given the opportunity of being absolved before heading into eternity. And I'm not aware of any cases where this has happened. I would suspect, due to human error, it has happened in church history. But you'd have a really high, really, really high burden of proof to deny somebody final absolution on grounds of insincerity.
Nate?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. All right, fair enough. What about, like, say someone's been excommunicated. Can they still – and they're dying.
Yeah,
they're
absolutely. And there are special provisions for remission of penalties in that situation.
Okay.
Because the church really, really wants to help you get right with God before you meet him face to face.
And you could even receive communion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see. I gotcha.
And you can even – there are even provisions. I mean, you can ask for any priest you want to hear your final confession if you're on your deathbed, and even it can even be a priest who's been laicized. So just anybody.
It's like any
who has the,
any boat in a storm now, right?
We want to give you every possible chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Let's go to Teresa in Columbus, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Teresa, your question for Jimmy Akin. Teresa?
Hi.
Hi.
I have got a real serious question for you.
Okay.
Are you really conservative, or do you lean more toward the concept of the basic 50 or the B-52? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, as far as I'm aware, the basic 50 is a program in square dancing confined to the 50 basic moves on the basic list, including Allemande left and circle left and right. I'm not sure what you're referring to. I think you have something else in mind. So why don't you tell me about it?
The real question I have is, you know, I do a lot of reading. I've got a whole bunch of encyclicals sitting there. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm trying to get through a book about Chesterton. I've got a book about Frodo sitting there.
Okay. Let's stipulate you've got a big library. How can I help you?
Yeah. And, you know, you look at these and you want to read them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a little bit, but it's hard to get motivated. It's hard to sit down. Do you have any suggestions?
For what to read?
Kind of a different question. Just for how to get around to read, or how much to try to read. I mean, I'm sure you read a bunch more mm-hmm. than most people do.
Yeah, I think that's fair, partly because of my occupation and just partly because of my interests and the circumstances of my life. Obviously, the amount that's appropriate for an individual to read is going to depend on a variety of different factors, including what else you have going on in your life. If you have husband or children living at home, that's obviously have to devote time to them. That's going to cut down on reading time. But there are often ways that we can find to read in situations that we might not otherwise. One of the things that I do is – and this is, again, going to be impacted by your family living situations, but I frequently listen to audiobooks when I'm in bed. I have an Alexa, and I'll have it read to me at night. I have a Kindle that does text-to-speech, and I have it read to me over my car speaker when I'm commuting. So those are ways that I can sneak in some extra reading time. I personally find it a lot easier to read things that are read out loud to me, either in audiobook form or in text-to-speech form. So I tend to go to those, but it really is up to you what works for you in your life. I would just suggest experimenting and looking for different times where you could squeeze in some reading, either in audiobook form or in ebook form or just in dead tree form, if that's what you prefer.
Teresa, thanks very, very much for that. You're going to need a microphone.
Okay.
I appreciate that call. I'm saying you're going to need a microphone because our director of marketing is here with us, Donna Barrick. Okay. And Donna, I wanted to ask you about how's the program going, where we have folks who are in parishes promoting Catholic Answers Live, promoting the work of Catholic Answers. How's that going? And we should probably tell people how they can participate as well.
Oh, thanks, Si. Yeah, it's going really well. So we started with an outreach to our parishes just by, you know, talking on the radio with our listeners and sending out some postcards to parishes. But what we really need our listeners to do is help us reach the people in the pews. And by doing that, we need them to contact us. So they can go to CatholicAnswersLive.com and click on Become a Partner. Or you can send us an email at calpartners@catholic.com, calpartners@catholic.com, so we can send out like a bunch of materials, flyers about the radio show, the types of programs we have, the guests we have, get some window clings for your cars and bumper stickers. And
I love that we have both.
Yeah.
Because there's a certain number of people who just don't want a bumper sticker on their car.
Yeah.
But then you got the window cling. Just stick it in the back window. And people will go, Catholic Answers Live, what's that? I got to find out more about that.
This is a new noun for me.
What?
Window cling.
Oh, you haven't heard of it?
No.
They're actually really good, too. There used to be the window clings. I don't think window cling technology was very advanced for a while. You'd cling them to the window, and about 2 days later, they'd be on the back seat.
Yeah.
But now they just stay.
Yeah, they're pretty good. I noticed I put one in my car, and I noticed that with the heat, it got like 108 degrees here in El Cajon, and it started to peel a little bit, but you can just stick
cool
it back
day.
On. Yeah, it was a cool day.
A cool summer day here in El Cajon.
Yeah, and then I doubled down and put one of these on my – first time I've ever done that is I put one on my bumper. I've never done that before, and I thought, I don't want to be a target for like Catholic people that might not like Catholics or something.
but so far, so good.
You know, I was a little nervous.
And where there's lots of markets where, for example, someone might know about us. They're listening on the app or something like that. There's not a Catholic radio station there that's easy for people to access. We'd love to have the bumper stickers there.
Right.
People can learn about Catholic Answers Live that way.
Yep.
There's just a million situations where somebody might look at that sticker, listen a little bit, and their life would be changed.
Yeah, I've talked to people that call in and donate sometimes to Catholic Answers, and they've said, well, one day I was just sitting in traffic and I saw this bumper sticker for Catholic radio.
Yeah,
we hear that all the time from callers.
It's awesome. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that don't know that Catholic Answers Live is just a program on Catholic radio. And so in some markets, they may not have Catholic Answers Live.
Yeah.
And so we want people to be able to know about the program and all the ways that they can listen through the app, through Sirius XM, on EWTN app, there's so many ways. So if we can get these materials to you and you can bring them to your parish for parish events, put them in the vestibule with your, pastor's approval to do that, or just stand outside Mass and just hand them out on Sundays, that would be great.
So you tell us again, how do you become a parish partner?
Become a parish partner. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com and click the Become a Partner button. It's that simple. It gives you some details, and it's a simple form. You just fill that out, and then we'll reach out to you and then provide the materials to you. Or you can email us at calpartners@catholic.com, calpartners.com.
CalPartners.com.
CalPartners, short for Catholic Answers Live.
Thanks, Donna.
Thanks, Si. Thanks,
really
Jimmy.
Appreciate it. I'm kind of shocked. We'll have to talk about this later. There are Catholic radio stations that don't have Catholic Answers Live on them. I can't even imagine why anyone would.
I think that's a myth.
Is it a myth?
Is it a myth?
A mythical Catholic radio station
like
without
unicorns and stuff.
Yeah, there's no reason not to listen. There's a way to get us no matter what.
That's a good point.
We're willing to give you our program no matter where you are if you're a radio station, and we're willing to give it to you over our apps and all kinds of other ways too.
Yeah, right.
For free.
For free. Anybody wants
you
it.
You want it, you can
stream
have
it through your app.
Stream
put it on
live,
your station.
Do the podcast.
Say it again, Catholic Answers Partners.
CalPartners@Catholic.com. CalPartners@Catholic.com.
CalPartners@Catholic.com. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice is our new radio show for young adults.
The Holy Spirit is about a new and exciting work in the young church of today. On Encounter, we bring young adults the life-changing testimonies of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission. Their testimonies bring faith and power into the lives of everyone who listens.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice. The spiritual awakening continues Saturday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin. Our guest, Jimmy Akin, is a senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and author of many things. I forgot about this. You got the Bible Difficulties one, too. 20 Answers Bible Difficulties.
I didn't forget about it.
I forgot to mention when I was mentioning all your voluminous writings earlier.
This is the latest one. The latest published one, I think so. I think that's right.
Yeah. You should do some more, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Some more 20 answers.
Well, you know, as soon as I get an outline approved, I will.
I'm not the guy that approves them. Anonymous in New York watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube, Anonymous. Your question for Jimmy?
Hey, Jimmy. My question today is on why the church bans membership to Freemasonry but doesn't ban membership to the Boy Scouts. I'm a recent Catholic convert who is both a third-degree Freemason and an Eagle Scout, and I was reading on the Catholic.com article about this that talks about how Freemasonry espouses indifferentialism and naturalistic religion, how it contains a moral code, vestments, prayer, worship, hierarchy, initiation, burial rites, and a lot of it shares a lot of those same things with Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few other reasons listed, like how it's a secret society and the intensity of the relationship with religion, but I think those tend to be like a matter of degree instead of a matter of substance.
Where were you reading this?
Like, why is that?
Where were you reading this?
On the what does the church say about Freemasonry on Catholic.com?
Oh, I see. Okay,
August 4th, 2011.
Okay. Well, I haven't read that piece, so and I don't know who wrote it, and that's fine. I don't need to for purposes of our discussion. You're right that Boy Scouts are an interreligious organization, and they have certain commonalities with other social groups, including Freemasonry. But Freemasonry does have some distinctives that make it unique. One of them is that it has a history in various places, not necessarily here in America in recent times, but in other countries in particular. It's had an agenda of attempting to actively subvert the church, and that's actually the canon that is deemed as prohibiting membership in Freemasonry in the Code of Canon Law, is that Catholics aren't to join organizations that are subversive of the church. And so that's one aspect of it. Now, not everywhere is it trying to subvert the church in an active, aggressive way. In fact, there are lots of lodges here in America that would say, "Oh, we don't care if you're Catholic; you're welcome to be a member of our lodge." But there are other difficulties. One of the terms you mentioned from the article is indifferentism, and indifferentism isn't just an inclusive attitude where you accept people of different religions in your club. Lots of clubs do that. The Boy Scouts do that. You know, every dance club I am a member of does not have a religious test for whether you join. And it's certainly possible to have organizations that accept different kinds of Christians or even members of other religions. The World Council of Churches would be an example of a multi-Christian organization that welcomes people from different Christian backgrounds. Having said that, there is a particular belief that some people have that goes beyond just welcoming people of different backgrounds, and actually saying it does not matter to God what your religion is. And that's one of the problems with Freemasonry. Freemasonry, at least as – and I'm not saying every Freemason claims this, but – historically, Freemasonry has adopted an indifferentist position that says God is indifferent to, he doesn't care what religion you are. And that's something that we know from the Bible is not true. God does care what religion you are. He may be willing to save people, you know, from different religious backgrounds, but he really wants you to be a Christian, and he really wants you to be in full communion with his son's church. So that's a point where Freemasonry involves theological error, whereas the Boy Scouts wouldn't. the Boy Scouts may say, we're a Christian organization, we welcome people from all kinds of Christian backgrounds, but they don't go so far as to say, and it doesn't matter to God what kind of Christian you are. In addition, there are some problems with some of the Masonic rites, which are modeled more closely after religious worship rituals than our common Boy Scout things. Like, you know, Boy Scout, the Scout's Oath is not – most people wouldn't look at that and feel like they're at church, mm-hmm. you know, when they have hear the Boy Scout's Oath. But some of the Masonic rituals get much more elaborate than that. And some of them involve the invocation of God, or in Masonic terms, the grand architect of the universe, in ways that are quite problematic from a Christian point of view. My understanding, my memory, is that at one of the higher level Masonic rituals in at least some Masonic traditions, there's an invocation of God using the name, if I have it right, Yabul Khan. And that's a hybrid name of three different deities, one of them being Yahweh, but another of them being Bel or Baal or Marduk. And any kind of hybridization of the true God with false gods is going to be very problematic from a Christian perspective. And that's the Boy Scouts aren't doing that, but apparently at least some Masons are. So I hope that sheds some light on your question, Anonymous.
Okay. All right, Anonymous. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's very useful. I'm a third degree Freemason, and I'm an Eagle Scout.
Uh huh.
And when I was in Boy Scouts, I was actually an atheist.
Uh huh.
And I was having trouble because Boy Scouts, just like Freemasonry, requires a belief in God.
Right.
And it seems like it's too fine of a point for me to differentiate easily.
Mm-hmm.
And although I am a third degree Freemason, I haven't heard that particular name of God invoked
mm-hmm.
that you mentioned.
Yeah, I once saw a reenactment. It was a demonstration. It wasn't the act. I've never been in a Masonic lodge, so, you know, I haven't seen actual rituals performed, but I did see a demonstration or reenactment of the ritual that was being done under the auspices of a former Mason. I'd have to do a little research to go back and find the actual ritual, but it is a significant difference to say, hey, we welcome people who believe in God, versus saying God doesn't care what your religion is as long as you believe in him. That's a significant shift in attitude.
Anonymous, we will leave it there. Thanks so much. I hope that was helpful to you. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Open forum means any question about the Catholic faith is welcome. When Jimmy's here, we usually like to say we broaden that out a little bit. If you have a more general religious question or philosophical, those are also welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. And as always, both Catholics and non-Catholics are welcome to call. Riley in Ann Arbor, listening on Catholic Radio 990. You are up next. Riley, your question for Jimmy. Riley?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. What's your question? We can. What's your question?
Okay, yeah. So I don't know what the difference is between different rites within the church. For example, the Byzantine rite and the Roman rite,
mm-hmm.
Or in any other rites that might exist. Mm-hmm. And I'm also trying to get into reading the church fathers, and uh-huh. I don't know exactly where to start. And word on the street is you wrote a book about that. That's
yeah.
what the call screener told me.
Okay.
Word on the street. On the streets, they're talking about your books, Jim.
Hey, how about that? So there are five – technically speaking, there are five rites in the Catholic Church. These are liturgical and legal traditions that inform the life of individual Catholic churches. The Latin rite is the largest or most widely used. There are others, including the Byzantine rite, the Chaldean rite, and so forth. Those five basic rites are then used by 21 different churches that are in communion with Rome. The largest of them is the Latin Church, and as the name suggests, it uses the Latin Rite. And then there are these other churches that each have their own law. They're called churches sui juris. And an example would be the Maronite Catholic Church, and another would be the Chaldean Catholic Church, both of which use one of the Eastern Rites rather than the Latin Rite. So properly speaking, a rite refers to a liturgical and legal tradition that's used by the different churches with their own laws that are in communion with Rome. Although popularly the term rite is also just used to refer to any of the churches with their own law. So that's kind of an overview of the basic concept. In terms of books on the Church Fathers, mine is called The Fathers Know Best. And another one that you might want to take a look at is called Early Christian Writings, edited by Maxwell Staniforth.
Riley, thanks so much for that question. The music's playing. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're waiting for your call. Grab that line and get on board.
Is the Church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Time is running out to help Catholic Answers' annual summer campaign. We're in the lean summer months, and this year we're forecasting a summer shortfall of $220,000 before our income picks up again later in the year. This is a crucial time because we need to offset that drop in donations. To make your donation and get your special thank you gifts, visit Catholic.com and click the summer campaign banner. Or call us toll-free at 888-291-8000. That's the summer campaign banner at Catholic.com, or call toll-free 888-291-8000.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our on-fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
I'm Tom Price.
And I'm Gloria Purvis. Tomorrow, Father Jordan Schmidt.
And we're talking summer food with Jeff Young. Join us for Morning Glory, 7 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Next hour, Jim Blackburn will be here. Open forum both hours. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, about Catholic beliefs, Catholic people, Catholic ideas, it's all welcome. Just give us a call, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer the spelled version. And we go now to Kelly in Spring, Texas, listening on 1430 AM. Kelly, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, guys. My question is regarding confession and communion. For Protestants. So I have a friend of mine who seems to be drawn toward those two things in our church. Mm-hmm. I'm born and raised Catholic. And my understanding is this person is going to communion. I don't know if she's gone to confession. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to kind of stay out of it. Mm-hmm. But wondering what the rules are, and what is the reason? What do you tell a Protestant? Hey, you can't go to confession, you can't go to communion because you're not Catholic. And then, of course, that makes it sound exclusionary and mean. Mm-hmm. And so what are the rules?
Okay.
And obviously a priest that's taking communion, it's not like you've got a Catholic card you give him, right? Whenever you, so he doesn't know. And so what are the rules there? And
okay, here's what the rules are. In the Code of Canon Law, there's a canon which you can look up online. It's called Canon 844, and it deals with the situations in which the sacraments can be administered to different groups of people. One of the parts of the canon deals with the situation of people who are Catholics. Another deals with the situation of people who are Eastern Orthodox or other Eastern Christians. And then there's a section on other Christians who aren't in communion with Rome. And that's the part of the canon that refers to Protestants. Basically, it says that there are some circumstances where they can receive certain sacraments. There are three sacraments that they can potentially receive. One of them is confession. Another is Holy Communion. And another is the anointing of the sick. And in the case of Protestants, the conditions are fairly strict for when they can receive them. One of them, in fact, the first condition, is there needs to be either danger of death or another grave necessity. And so if you have a Protestant and they're in danger of dying or they have some other grave need to receive the Eucharist or confession or the anointing of the sick, then that meets the first of the conditions. Another condition is they need to share the church's faith in the sacrament. They need to believe about it what we do, at least in general terms. So they need to believe, for example, in the case of the Eucharist, they need to believe that Jesus is really there, that it's not just bread. In the case of confession, they need to believe that God will absolve them through this. In the case of the anointing of the sick, they need to believe that God will give them his grace through this sacrament, possibly including healing if it's his will. So they need to share our faith in these sacraments. They also need to ask for them on their own and not be like coerced into it by somebody. And they need to have the proper dispositions, you know, like in the case of the Eucharist, they need to fast for an hour beforehand. And also they need to not be able to approach a minister of their own communion for the same sacrament. So in this country, those conditions aren't met very frequently by people who are Protestant and have no interest in becoming Catholic. But it is possible for them to receive those sacraments. And so it's reasonable to say, you know, there are situations in which you could receive a sacrament like this. And so that is a way of taking some of the edge off of saying, no, you can't. But then you need to deliver the other part of the message if you're, you know, getting involved and telling them the truth about the church's rules on this. Because the general rule is, even though there are situations where you can receive these sacraments, most of the time they don't apply. And one of the reasons for that is the church has always viewed communion in particular as a sign of full unity. That if you're receiving from the Lord's table with us, that's a sign that you fully are in agreement with us, that you're fully in union with us. And if you're not fully in union with us at the moment, then under ordinary circumstances, you shouldn't be receiving, because it misrepresents the fact that you're not actually fully in union with us. It's great that we're in partial union, and if one day we're in full union, let's say you become a Catholic, there's no more barrier. But apart from special circumstances, like if you were dying, you ordinarily shouldn't be receiving. Having said that, if I would go a step further and say, if she's responding to the church's teachings about confession and communion and recognizing the value of those sacraments, I'd say that's an invitation to go further, to study deeper, and to look at other issues with an open mind towards whether the Catholic Church might be right. That's an attitude that I had when I was Protestant. I realized the Catholic Church had certain truths that I wasn't finding represented in the same way in the Protestant community. I realized I needed to look at other issues with an open mind, to whether the Catholic Church might be right. And when I did that, I concluded it was right and I needed to become a Catholic. And so that's the course I would recommend for her.
Okay, Kelly.
Okay, that sounds good. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
No problem.
888-31-TRUTH, the number. Open forum means anybody can call with any question they have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. We go now to Gary in Ennisville, Ontario, Canada, listening on shortwave. That's cool, Gary. Thanks for your call. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Gary here. My question today is regarding St. John the Apostle.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to know if we have any first-class relics, or if we know where his burial site is, or if he was assumed into heaven.
Okay. To answer the questions in reverse order, he was not assumed into heaven, and we do have a good idea of where his burial site is. It's located in Ephesus, which is on the coast, on the west coast of Turkey today. Back then, it was the Roman province of Asia Minor. But today it's part of Turkey. And you can actually go visit his tomb. I've been there. But there's a complication because there were two famous Johns in the early church. Actually, there was more than that. But there were two who were particularly famous and who are buried at Ephesus. One of them, according to early Christian writings, is John the Apostle. And the other is a figure known as John the Presbyter, who was also an eyewitness of the ministry of Jesus. And so both of these eyewitnesses of the ministry of Jesus, the apostle and the presbyter, both ended up going to Ephesus and perishing there, which is why they're both buried there in separate tombs. So we know we have good reason to think, okay, one of these two tombs is John the Apostle's, but we're not 100% sure of which one. And in terms of the first question you asked, which I'll answer last, I am not aware of any first-class relics of John. I would not at all be surprised if there are some out there that are reported to be first-class relics of his, but I am unaware of any, and I would suggest Googling the matter. Just type in John, Apostle, first-class relic, see what comes up. I would be a little skeptical of such relics because he died at such an early date that it was long before the custom of taking relics from the remains of a saint had emerged. In his own day, they would have just buried his body. And the only way we would have relics is if someone later came along and exhumed or partially exhumed the body to take relics. And that could have happened, but one would want some historical evidence of it happening.
Okay, Gary?
When did the custom start of collecting relics?
My memory is that it started by the 3rd century. I seem to remember there was a case of a woman in the 200s who got in trouble with a local priest for wanting to venerate an unauthenticated bone of a martyr. But I remember reading about that in a book on church history by the Quaker historian Roland Bainton. But I would have to look up the details. But I believe that was in the 200s. It didn't become firmly established until later is my understanding.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks very much. Hope that was helpful. That's EWTN with that shortwave signal that goes all around,
yeah,
all around the world, as far as I know. Appreciate that. Jimmy, we were talking a little bit before about your latest published book being, mm-hmm, Bible Difficulties, and you got a whole bunch of them here. And
uh-huh.
I did want to remind folks that—
Copies of the book?
No. I meant— Wait, how do I, what did I just?
Because I only see one copy of the book.
I meant copies
I
of your other books.
I had a whole bunch of them here.
A whole bunch of your books here. That's
okay.
I just got a little ahead of myself, maybe. But all of them are on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. As a matter of fact, almost all of our total stock of books, audio, DVDs, tracks, digital products, all on sale, 10 to 25% off. In some cases, more than 25% off, including all of these. Look at these things I have in front of me. Jimmy Akin, Understanding Revelation. That's a DVD. Mm-hmm. Why You Can Trust the Gospels. That's a DVD. That's last year you did that DVD, right? That was I remember when that came out.
I don't recall specific dates.
Well, I follow you.
Oh.
I follow your career.
Okay. Stalking me is what you're saying.
A little bit. Okay. Am I the only one, Jimmy? Come on, you're Jimmy Akin. The Fathers Know Best, the book we were talking about a little bit earlier, The Drama of Salvation, A Daily Defense, all that. Just go to shop.catholic.com and start saving right now. You don't need a promo code. There is no promo code. It's all on sale. Shop.catholic.com.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I come from the other side of the tracks, see? My uncle used to have slot machines. Put one nickel in and it's emptied. And I brought him home in a bag, and my mother looked at me. Where did you get all that money? I said, I won them. You didn't win them. He fixed the machine. I didn't care if he fixed the machine or not, you know?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic. Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, open forum, our topic. Lots of folks on the lines, but we've got another hour coming up. If you want to get in the queue, just dial 888-318-7884, and you will be in the queue. We go now to John in Chicago, watching on Facebook. John, your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I would just like an overview of how real the struggle was for Catholics before the it was legalized in the 300s. Mm-hmm. Like, was every emperor bad? Were there some emperors who were good? Like, what was it like? How real was the struggle?
Okay. Basically, there was a cycle of persecution, but it waxed and waned. That means it went up and went down. So there were periods in which there were local persecutions. We read about some of those in the New Testament. For example, in Acts chapter 12, we read that King Herod Agrippa I, around the year AD 43, arrested some early Christians, including James the Apostle, and executed James and tried to execute Peter. That would be one example of a local persecution. Similarly, when Stephen in Acts chapter 7 was stoned by the Sanhedrin when he was stoned to death, that would be another example of local persecution. We read in elsewhere in Acts, like when Paul is in Philippi, in the Macedonian city of Philippi in Acts chapter 16, he was in the process of being beaten. And they took him to prison overnight, so he was jailed. And he later invoked his Roman citizenship, which they should not have beaten a Roman citizen without trial. So they really apologized fast and got him out of town. So there was sporadic persecution. The most famous early widespread persecution occurred in Rome beginning in the year AD 65. You commonly hear it said that it's AD 64, but it's really 65. What happened was in AD 64, a fire broke out in Rome. And it was a very destructive fire. It destroyed large portions of the city. And afterwards, Nero started building a lot of fancy buildings, including he also worked on one he called his House of Gold, his Domus Aurea, which was this like really fancy golden palace. And people started to say, hey, I think Nero set that fire just so he could clear ground for his building projects. And so this rumor got started. And Nero at first tried to deny it and tried to deflect blame in various ways. And eventually he said, okay, guys, here's the straight scoop. It was set by those Christians.
And so and it took a while for that process of events to play out before the rumor got really firm enough for Nero to take it seriously. And then he tried to deny it in other ways. And he may not have done it. It may have been totally accidental fire. But eventually, by AD 65, he started to settle on Christians as the arsonists. And so he then began to persecute Christians in the city of Rome itself. Saint Peter was killed during that martyrdom, during that persecution. Also, huge numbers of other Christians were arrested and executed. According to the reports we have from Roman historians, Nero, they were accused of arson, of setting the city on fire, he set them on fire. He would burn them alive at night in his gardens as living human torches. And he was so cruel that even the pagans in Rome, who didn't really like the Christians, thought this is just excessive. This is just one man's barbarity. Mm-hmm. These Christians don't deserve this. And Nero, for other reasons, made himself additionally unpopular and ended up being declared an enemy of the state by the Roman Senate in AD 68 and was sort of forced to commit suicide. And that ended his persecution. Now, another emperor later on in the first century, Domitian, who reigned in the AD 90s, is sometimes thought to have initiated a persecution, but our evidence there is a lot shakier. Also, there was the Emperor Trajan around the year 112. One of the governors named Pliny the Younger wrote him a letter saying, "Hey, I've got these Christians here that were reported to me. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do about them. I haven't ever been to a trial of Christians before. What can you tell me?" And Trajan wrote back and said, "Well, don't go seek them out, but if they're reported to you, they need to be punished, and here are some procedures." And that illustrates the fact that Pliny didn't know the procedures, indicates there wasn't an active, aggressive persecution happening at that time, which is also indicated by Trajan's response that don't seek him out. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a waxing and waning of persecutions. One of the most severe persecutions occurred shortly before Christianity was legalized under the Emperor Diocletian, who was very aggressive and initiated an empire-wide persecution of Christianity that produced many martyrs. But for much of the time, being a Christian was kind of like being a second-class citizen. You kind of kept it on the down low that you were a Christian, but you weren't actively being persecuted much of the time.
How does that strike you, John?
Just as a follow-up, were there any good guys emperors who were relatively benevolent,
ones? There were ones who were – they had different degrees of benevolence, and probably one of the – before Constantine, one of the potentially most benevolent emperors was a guy who lived in the 200s named Philip the Arab. And he was an actual Arab ethnically. You could become a citizen of Rome eventually if you had an ancestry that was non-Roman, and you could even rise to become emperor. And Philip the Arab, from what we can tell, at least from early Christian sources, was apparently fairly friendly to Christians and even may have believed in Christ himself. But he didn't do what he didn't have the same role in history that later Constantine the Great would in the early 300s.
Thanks so much for that question, John. I was actually fascinated to hear a whole lot of that. It was Philip the Arab. I'm going to have to look him up,
yeah.
Philip the Arab. But around when was he?
He was in the 200s. I want to say that around 260.
Uh-huh. And help me out, because I do not remember this. There's a period where they call the five good emperors. Are there Marcus Aurelius among them?
Yeah. That phase is a little after where I've done the most study.
I see. I got you.
But yeah, I thought for a second you were going to refer to the year of four emperors, where you had four in rapid succession. It was
that's not a good
to
year.
To quote George
for the
Lucas,
Empire.
It was a time of civil war.
I guess so. Yeah, because those things were not resolved with a Supreme Court decision in those days. So let's go to Carlo in San Diego, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app on your phone, Carlo. Your question for Jimmy. Carlo?
Hello, Jimmy. How are you doing?
Just fine.
All right. So I've been a baptized member of the Roman Catholic Church, but, you know, never been catechized, never went to Mass, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, recently, I came to the Christian faith, and I became an Orthodox Christian, Greek Orthodox,
mm-hmm.
and I was chrismated just last December. But recently, I realized that the divisions between the two churches were much more complicated. I could even wrap my head around half of them.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, you know, in the meantime, is there any, you know, am I in any serious spiritual danger should I never submit to Rome, you know, before I leave this earth?
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Well, first of all, we wouldn't frame it as Catholics in terms of submitting to Rome. I mean, that language has been used in the past, but these days the church speaks in terms of coming into full communion with rather than submitting. And in terms of if you never became Catholic, never came into full communion with the Catholic Church – well, that from a Catholic perspective, that's not what God wants for you. Whether it would constitute a barrier to your salvation will depend on the level of knowledge you have. You mentioned you were baptized Catholic but never catechized in the Catholic faith. And right now you're at an early stage where you don't have a lot of knowledge about the reasons for the separation or you know, which church you ought to be a member of. So God understands your lack of knowledge at this point and will take that into account. If you were to say, you know, I just don't care about this question. I don't care where God wants me. I'm not going to study this. Well, saying you don't care about God's will is something that could jeopardize your salvation. You know, the fact you're asking this question, the fact that you're willing to look into these matters is itself a sign of God's grace working in your life. And I would encourage you to keep studying. And we have, resources here that could potentially help you. And we're always happy to answer particular questions either here on Catholic Answers Live or when you call our apologist line. So we're here to help.
Before I go, could you recommend me a resource for not so much on the papacy stuff,
mm-hmm.
but Filioque?
Yeah.
I haven't seen much of that.
Okay. We actually have some articles about that at Catholic.com that are available there for free. If you just go to Catholic.com and type in Filioque. Also, the Catechism of the Catholic Church has a treatment of this that you can find in the section on the Holy Spirit, and you can find the Catechism of the Catholic Church at the Vatican website at vatican.va. The quick way to get it is just type in on Google Catechism of the Catholic Church, Filioque, and it should take you to the exact passage you need. And I've also written about it a little bit myself, but I would just suggest starting with Catholic.com and the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Thanks, Carlo. Let's see if we can get one more question in before we have to go. Let's go to John in Orlando, Florida, listening on EWTN Radio. John, your question for Jimmy. Do we have him there? Got a little bit of phone trouble. John, are you there? Well, I'm going to tell you what his question is because he may still be on the line. We're just having a little technical problem
right
today. His question, Jimmy, is what is the etymology of the word apologetics?
Okay. It comes from the Greek word apologia, which means a defense. And so when Socrates, in Plato's dialogue, The Apology, when Socrates gives his apology to the men of Athens, he's giving his legal defense of his position against the charges against him,
mm-hmm.
which were that he was corrupting the youth and promoting disbelief in the gods. And he said, I'm not doing either one of those. In a Christian context, apologetics then is the defense of the faith, where you provide evidence for the faith and answer objections to it. The roots that apologia comes from are apa, which is a preposition in Greek that means from, and logia, which means a speech. And so an apologia, based on its etymology, is a speech from a position. And then it came to mean from that a defense of a position.
Well, John, I'm sorry we weren't able to actually talk with you, but I hope that that answer was satisfying. It's the quality of answers like that that are why Jimmy's the senior apologiaist here at
Thank you very much, Cyril Kelly.
Apologia.
Our radio house.
Oh, man. Sometimes, you know, you just make me look silly with that. I don't know why you do that, Jimmy. I don't know why you feel that's all right.
I'm having fun with you.
I know. Jimmy Akin, thanks very, very much. As always, a great hour. Next hour, we're still going to keep doing this. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, you can get in that line, and you will probably get to you. I'm pretty sure we'll get to you next hour. 888-318-7884, the number. If you're Catholic, if you're not Catholic, everybody's welcome. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Next hour, Jim Blackburn in here to take your questions. We'll get to that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.